Exodus 2, verses 11 to 25, the fifth talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on November 8, 2015, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 5, Exodus 2:11 to 2:25, accompanies this talk.
The author has reminded us of the situation in which the Israelites found themselves, that they were in Egypt. They had gone down there with Jacob to join Joseph to be saved from the famine. So they are in Egypt, and they've been there a long time, but a new king arose, and that king was concerned about the growing number of Israelites in their midst, and he decided that the way to address that problem was to enslave the Israelites. So the Israelites were enslaved. It was a cruel slavery, but it did not achieve the goals that the Pharaoh had set out for that strategy. So he put them in a position where they had to work harder. That, too, did not provide the results that he wanted, so he enlisted the help of the Hebrew midwives, and he asked them to terminate the lives of any boys that were born to the Israelites right when they were born. They chose not to obey his commands, and so the Pharaoh took further action and asked all of the people of Egypt that if they saw a male child, to cast it into the Nile to kill it. So there was a Levite couple that had a child and kept him in their house for 3 months. But at the end of 3 months, they decided that he was too much of a risk to keep him in the house. And so his mother built a basket, lined it with pitch, and put it into the Nile with the baby in the basket, in the ark. And that basket was found by the daughter of Pharaoh, and she wanted to keep it for her own rather than dumping it into the Nile. And the child's sister was watching and offered the services of her mother to nurse this orphaned baby, and that is the arrangement that was made. So this child, who was then named Moses, was raised initially by his own mother, but when he was older, he was turned over to the Pharaoh's daughter, and he was raised in the Pharaoh's household. As I pointed out last week, as such, that is, as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter, in all likelihood, he received the education that was available to the noble family in Egypt. And we know from extra-biblical sources that it was the practice in Egypt at this particular period in time, whether we're talking about the Middle Kingdom period or the New Kingdom period, apparently they did this in both time periods. The Egyptians, who were concerned about Palestine and concerned about the kings of Palestine, and I say kings because each city had its own king. So there were a lot of kings in Palestine, even though they were kings over just a city. The Egyptians were worried about their behavior and their loyalty to Egypt, and as a result, they would take the sons of the kings in Palestine, take them to Egypt, and give them the best education that was available in the world at that time. And while they were there, they were watched, and if the father did anything out of line in Palestine, that father knew that his child was in jeopardy. So Moses, in all probability, was educated in that setting, and educated about the culture the religion, social practices of Egypt, as well as those same things with respect to Palestine. And that's interesting because learning about Palestine would be learning about something that was much closer to his very own culture and traditions. Okay, verses 11 through 14. Now it came about in those days, when Moses had grown up, that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And he went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he said, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." This whole section I find fascinating, and we'll talk about some of the things I think that are really significant that come out of this. Moses, clearly, as a result of having been raised for at least a period of time, we don't know how long, but raised by his mother, he has grown up to one degree or another, because of that upbringing, identifying with the Hebrews over against the Egyptians. You can imagine that in this situation, he's the adopted son of the daughter of Pharaoh. There are lots of privileges that come with that position in life. And there would be lots of reasons to just embrace Egyptian culture wholesale, because he has lots to gain from that. But on the other hand, his mother, his father are Hebrews, and I'm sure he was raised with the knowledge that he was born a Hebrew and that there's some kind of affinity there. So there's got to be a war for his loyalties at one level or another going on in his soul. We hear that he goes out then into society to see what's going on. We learn later that he is 40 years old at this time. So I think it's unlikely that what we're talking about here is the first time he's gone out. He's in all likelihood gone out many times. But for some reason, this one becomes particularly significant. And it could be that just circumstances pushed him to act the way that he did on this occasion, but it could be that there's been a progression of thought in his thinking that has built up to this event and erupts at this particular moment in time. As he goes out, what he sees is his brethren, and it uses the word brethren twice in this passage, so he's clearly identifying with them. He goes out and he sees his brethren being put to hard labor. Furthermore, he sees an Egyptian foreman strike one of the Hebrews. And clearly, as a result of that, he is incensed. He sees something in what has happened as being outrageously wrong. So he takes action, but it's interesting. The passage makes it really clear that he deals with this foreman who has done this wrong, but he does so in a way that he's unlikely to get caught. He looks around to make sure that nobody else is looking. So he finds the opportunity, and then he strikes the Egyptian, just as the Hebrew slave had been struck by the Egyptian. Except this one's deadly. We don't know what the effect of the first one was. So he strikes him, and he kills him. And then he buries him under the sand so that it is hidden. So Moses is thinking, he has carried out this act clandestinely. He's carried it out in such a way that he will not be found out. And I think that's interesting. He is not trying to stage a rebellion. He's not saying, "Come on, troops, we're all going to rise up and revolt against the Egyptians." That's not the kind of action that this is. He is punishing this one Egyptian, but he's trying to do it secretly. He's not doing it publicly. So he goes out the next day, and he sees a situation, in which there are two Hebrews that are having some kind of dispute. And we have an unusual statement in this section. It is very rare in Old Testament narrative for you to get a value judgment coming directly from the narrator. But we do here, because he says, "So when he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and he said to the offender," so it makes it explicit that one person is clearly in the wrong, and it's to that one that Moses speaks. There are a number of indications in this first part of Exodus that Moses is the kind of person that identifies very strongly with the wronged, with those who are being mistreated. We saw that with the Egyptian who he killed because he had struck the slave. And now again, we have a fight between two Hebrews, and he asks the offender, "What are you doing here? What's going on here?" And we'll see other situations later in, as we move along through the narrative. So clearly we're seeing Moses as that kind of person who is interested in defending the rights of the wronged. His statement is, "Why are you striking your companion?" Robert Alter makes an interesting comment at this point. He wrote The Art of Biblical Narrative, and he's written a couple of other books, but I find him very helpful. And he specializes in studying the literary aspects of the Old Testament. And he makes the observation. He says, "The first dialogue assigned to a character in biblical narrative typically defines the character." So he says he sees the first quotation from any character in the Old Testament as being very significant, because usually it gives you some clue as to how the narrator views that particular character. And in this case, Moses' first speech is a reproof to a fellow Hebrew and an attempt to impose a standard of justice. The offender then responds. And the offender says, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us?" I can just hear that. He didn't say, "No, I didn't do wrong. You don't understand the situation. I didn't do wrong." He doesn't defend himself at all. He just says, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us?" So it's not defending his action. He doesn't care about whether his action is right or wrong. His concern is, "No one has the right to stand over me and tell me whether I have done wrong or right." Then he goes on to say, "Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" He's just pulled out his trump card. What he's saying is, "I know something that could get you killed. I have power over you. Don't you tell me I've been doing wrong. I'm in a position to put you to death." Moses understands very clearly the nature of the situation. It says, "Then Moses was afraid and he said, 'Surely the matter has become known.'" This is interesting to me, because as we continue on through Exodus, we'll see more and more of Moses' character and the way he's thinking about things. But clearly, this event cut him to the core. Because you can imagine Moses is thinking, and I really think that this is what he's thinking. He's thinking, "I was born under unique circumstances. I was given a mission by God. I was sent to help my people get out of slavery, escape from slavery." I don't know if he knew how what that would look like or anything, but I think that he thought that he had that mission. It says in Acts 7, and Acts 7 is an interesting passage to read. I highly recommend it, because this is where Stephen is about to be stoned, and he's surrounded by Jews that are accusing him of doing bad-mouthing the temple and bad-mouthing Moses, and they think that he's worthy of being stoned. And Stephen gives a defense, and he gives in one chapter a history of the nation of Israel. And in it, he talks about Moses and the role that Moses played. And he says in Acts 7:25, "And he," that is Moses, And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. So Moses thinks that he has this mission. He's going to save his people. He is in a privileged and unique kind of situation where he is positioned to help them. And yet, when he does something to help them, I mean, he took vengeance on this Egyptian that had beat up the slaves. When he acts on behalf of his people, instead of acting with gratitude, they say, "Who are you to be a prince or a judge over us?" And I think from this time on, Moses is just, he's thinking, "I cannot lead this people. This is a people that no one could lead, certainly not me." And we'll see that coming out later in the narrative. Okay, so Moses, having become aware that this matter had become known, he flees. And it's interesting, there's a sense in which this is very providential. The fact that this Hebrew has indicated to Moses that it is known that he had killed an Egyptian gives him time to escape from Egypt before he's killed. So for a second time, Moses escapes death in Egypt. And I find it interesting, these little providential things that happen through the narrative, that they appear to be bad, but on the other hand, there's a good side to it. Okay, the next section. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon today?" So they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." And he said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat." And Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." So Moses finds out that it is known that he had killed the Egyptian, and he knows he's got to get out of town. He's got to flee. So he takes off, and he goes east of Egypt, goes through the Sinai, and goes to the land of Midian. Now, it is not known for sure where Midian, what would have been the area named Midian at this time. It was either the eastern part of the Sinai, or it was the western part of the Saudi Peninsula. But it's some place in that area right around the Gulf of Aqaba, the area right at the end of the Arba. If you look at maps in your Bible, you can see where that's located. Midian would have been a land that is sparsely populated, that has primarily shepherds. There are some Midianites that are involved in long-distance trade with camel caravans. And there are some Midianites that would have been involved in mining ores and working with metal. Who are the Midianites? Interestingly, if you'll recall, Abraham, when his wife Sarah died, he married again. And he married a woman by the name of Keturah, and they had a child, Midian. And so that was the origin of the Midianites. It was from child of Abraham through Keturah. We know that later on in history, after Israel is settled and becomes a kingdom, there is a lot of tension between the Israelites and the Midianites, and they become mortal enemies. But at this early time, they seem to have been on relatively friendly terms. Sarna says, "The friendly relations between Israel and the Midianites that are reflected in the story of Moses are consonant with the account in Genesis 25:2, that traces the lineage of Midian back to Abraham. They also accord with the later report in Exodus chapter 18 of Midianite influence upon the organization of the Israelite judiciary system. This amicable situation must be both authentic and quite early, because toward the end of the period of the wilderness wanderings and during the period of the judges, relations between Israel and Midian were thoroughly hostile. No one, therefore, would likely have invented such stories depicting the Midianites in so favorable a light, with very close kinship ties to Israel. So his point there is, especially he's thinking with respect to those who argue that the Pentateuch was written at a late date, that if someone were to write it at a late date, it's unlikely that they would have depicted the Midians as being on friendly terms with the Israelites. Now, it doesn't mention in this passage the Kenites, but just for your information, the Kenites appear to have been a subset of the Midianites. And the Kenites, in particular, worked with metals. That was their forte, was working with metals. And the Kenites develop a very close relationship with the Israelites. And in fact, the Kenites are subsumed into the tribe of Judah at a later date. And if I'm not mistaken, one of the spies, Caleb, was a Kenite, and one of those who was allowed to live and to enter into Canaan with the rest of the Israelites. Okay, so we know that going way back, the Midianites and the Israelites were on very good terms. So he goes to Midian, he sits down by a well, and you could imagine that he is a bit shell-shocked. He has had a traumatic experience in Egypt where his life has just ended in a sense. At least his purpose in life is gone. And he finds himself not in a cultured place like he was used to, where he was raised, but he finds himself in the opposite of that, the thing that was hated by the culture in which he was raised, out with shepherds, out in the desert, and he obviously is out of his element, I think. But he sits down by a well, and what he sees is the daughters of a priest, and I'll talk about that in just a minute, the daughters of a priest come, they are herding their father's flocks, and they come to get water from the well. And they begin to draw the water out of the well and pour it into troughs for the sheep to drink. And these other shepherds come along and drive these girls away. And these other shepherds are going to take advantage of the fact that these girls had poured all of the water into the troughs for their sheep, and these shepherds are going to allow their sheep to drink without them having to draw that water and pour it out into the troughs. Clearly, there is an injustice that's been done here. Here are shepherds that are taking advantage of the labor of these girls and of the fact that they are girls and can be bullied by them. So again, Moses sees that and he can't help but respond. He's got to do something in the situation. And he does. He drives these shepherds off and he draws the water for their sheep, and their sheep drink, and they are able to then take their herds and go home. And they go home to their father, Reuel. It's not clear who this man is. We don't have much evidence. Reuel is going to show up later in Exodus, about chapter 18-ish. So we get a little bit more there, but we don't know much about who he is. And there's some confusion with respect to his name in the various places that he is mentioned. And Sarna argues that the word Jethro that is sometimes used for him appears to be a title. So Jethro's a title. His name is Reuel, but sometimes he's called Hobab, H-O-B-A-B. And those apparently are two different names for the same person. So there are different passages that refer to him, and the way that they refer to him varies, and that causes a certain amount of confusion, but that seems to be the way that it works out. Now, we don't know much about him, but we know that he was a priest, and he appears to have been a worshiper of Yahweh, which is not implausible in that he is a descendant of Abraham. To the extent that he is a descendant of Abraham, it seems just as likely that he would have retained some knowledge of Yahweh as an Israelite in Egypt would have retained some knowledge of Yahweh. And there's evidence that that happened. So I suspect that that's the case. I suspect that in his family, that knowledge has been passed down and retained, and that he acknowledges the same God that Moses acknowledges. The daughters then tell their... Oh, he says, why are you back so soon? So obviously, this bullying is an activity that has happened on a regular basis. So he asks, why are you back so soon? And they explain what happened. And Jethro says, well, go get the man and invite him home. So they go and find him, invite him home. And he eats a meal with them and ends up staying longer. And in fact, ends up marrying the daughter of Jethro, Zipporah. Eventually then, she gives birth to a son, and his name is Gershom. Gershom means foreigner there. Ger means a foreigner, a resident alien, someone who living in a land that is not their own land. And Gershom then is a foreigner or resident alien there. And he gives that name because he says, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. And I'll talk about that in a little bit with respect to the conclusion. Okay, verse 23. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. And the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God remembered their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. There's several interesting things about this little passage. The first, it says, it came about in the course of those many days. Many days. This is 40 years. This isn't many days, this is many years. So it's been a long time. Moses has been out in the desert for 40 years. And at that point in time, the king of Egypt died. The king of Egypt dying is significant, as I've talked before, that when one king dies and another king comes to the throne, there are typically changes that take place. There's instability, but there are also changes that take place. There would have been reason for the Israelites in Egypt to at least hope for a change in their situation. And that could very well be what they were thinking. But another significance of that is we know from extra-biblical sources that it was common when a king died for the new king to proclaim amnesty with respect and pardons for people who had been arrested under the previous pharaoh. So there's reason to think then that Moses might be able to return to Egypt under that kind of amnesty. So, the Pharaoh has died, things have changed, the situation in Egypt has changed, and it's at this point that God decides to begin to take action. Now, in these verses, there are terms that are piled up with respect to the sons of Israel. They sighed because of their bondage. They cried out. Their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So you see the piling up of terms describing their mental state, the situation that the Israelites find themselves in. And in the book of Exodus, the author likes to pile up terms like that when he wants to make a point. We've seen it before, we'll see it again. It also piles up terms with respect to God's response to the outcries. He heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant. He saw the sons of Israel. He took notice of them. So four terms, all describing God's interest now in their plight and apparent willingness to do something about it. So this passage then marks the point in time in which God is putting things into motion to begin doing something to address the problem of his people being in slavery in Egypt. Okay, I like this passage quite a lot, and I have thought about it on a number of occasions in a number of respects. And there are three things that I want to talk about in particular. The first one is the situation that Moses is in and kind of his mental state. I think Moses fits into a pattern that we see in history that is very significant and has repeated itself many times. And the term that I was taught to use for this is rootless intellectuals. Rootless, R-O-O-T-L-E-S-S, rootless, not ruthless. It's intellectuals without, that don't belong anywhere. And the first place that I ran into that is in the history of Russia. In the middle of the 1800s, there was a new social group within Russian society that emerged, and they become very important in later Russian history, and they were called the intelligentsia. It's a term that was, I think the term intelligentsia was first used to apply to this group in Russia. Now, who are they? They are the young Russians who were the first group of people to be educated in the Russian universities. There were no Russian universities that were really of any size and were fully operative until the early 1800s. By the middle of the 1800s, there were several hundred young Russian, mostly men, that were being educated in these schools. The background of these young men is that most of them were born into aristocratic families. Not all of them, but most of them. And in Russia at this time, an educated person needed to be raised speaking either German, French, or English extremely well. So what would typically happen is an aristocratic family would hire either a German, an English, or a French tutor to raise their children and to educate them and speak to them in that language all the time so that that became their first language, their native language. So you have these young Russian aristocrats being raised in Russia but being given a Western European education, being taught to speak a Western European language as their native tongue. Some of them didn't learn to speak Russian until much later in their life, and some of them, it was not uncommon for them to speak Russian with an accent. But they're Russians, fully Russians. So that is a portion of these students, that's probably the larger portion of these students, fits into that category. A smaller portion of these students, they are from peasant villages, or they could be a merchant's son or something, and they make their way through the kind of rudimentary education system in Russia until they get to the place where they are old enough to go to college. They go to college. And for them to get a college education is just amazing. It's a huge privilege. Well, these young students, as they're becoming young men, what they're thinking is, especially if they come from an aristocratic family, they were taught that as an aristocratic family, as a member of the Russian aristocracy, you are obligated, because of the privileges that you have received, you are obligated to serve your society. And those who come from peasant backgrounds, they also are receiving a huge privilege in being allowed to go to the university when that's very rare. And they come out thinking, I got a rare gift and I want to use it to help my people. So it is in this group of young intellectuals in Russia that there is a huge impetus to do whatever they can to better the future of the peasantry of Russia. And the peasantry is between 80 and 90% of the population at this time. So the vast majority of Russians are peasants, and they want to use their education and their gifts and their skills to help that group of people. They feel highly motivated to do that. At a time when, in Russian history, especially since the French Revolution in the late 1700s, especially since then, the rulers of Russia have decided we need to take complete control of the government and all activities happening within our society. Because if we don't take control, something is going to happen here like happened in France. So they're looking out at society, and any place they see people organizing themselves to do something, that makes them nervous. Well, the intelligentsia is organizing itself to do things to better the situation for the peasants. That makes the government very nervous, and they do everything they can to frustrate those efforts and to bust up those groups. As a result, these young intellectuals become extremely frustrated, and as a result, they start taking more radical activity. And there is a summer, I don't remember exactly the date, 1860-something, it's called the Back to the People movement, when all of the college students decide they're going to spend their summer vacation living out in the countryside with the peasants. And what they want to do is explain to the peasants their situation and what can be done to organize themselves to improve their conditions. So these intellectuals go out to the countryside and they say, "All right, everybody gather around. Here's what we're going to do." And they start laying out the plan. And the response of the peasants is, "What do you mean we? You don't even speak Russian. You aren't one of us. We are completely different." And they could not break down that barrier and communicate with the peasants. As a result, what do? They go back to the city and they start making bombs. And that becomes the Russian revolutionary movement, grows out of that. I think that's a fascinating phenomenon, where you have these gifted young people who are living in a culture in which the people that they identify with is suffering, and the education that they are provided is an alien education. And as a result, they have one foot in two different camps. They have one foot in the camp of the Russian peasants. They have one foot in the camp of the elite culture. But the reality is they don't belong to either one. They aren't accepted in either place. They aren't accepted in the village because they aren't a peasant. They aren't accepted as the ruling elite because they're just college students and they're just trouble. And it's out of that situation that you typically get the revolutionaries. And if you look at the revolutionary activity across the world since then, that is the typical profile for a revolutionary. A few years ago, I read The Looming Tower, which I highly recommend. It's about 9/11, and it is still relevant because it lays out all of the key players in that, and those key players and the movements that they started keep showing up in the news even today. But one of the things that struck me when I was reading that is the backgrounds of most of the revolutionaries that were organizing the 9/11 event and things since then are very similar to what I've just described. They are young Arabs growing up in an Arab country. They come out of a village in whatever country that they're in, but they are given a Western education. And the fact that they've been given a Western education, they begin to adopt, to one degree or another, the values of Western culture and the way of thinking of Western culture to a certain extent. And so when they go back to the village doesn't accept them. You aren't one of us. But neither are they a Westerner. And they can't make it as a Westerner. They don't have the same options that are open to them that someone in Western culture does. And that frustration of not being able to use my education and giftedness, that I don't have the channels by which I can use that to help the people that I identify with, and they won't accept that help, leaves me in no man's land. And that's what creates the frustration that turns someone into a revolutionary. I think that's a fascinating pattern. Moses fits into this pattern surprisingly well. It's the same kind of thing. So he is raised as an Egyptian with an Egyptian education, but he identifies with the people of with the Israelites. And yet, so he wants to use his privilege to help his people, but his people won't have it. They aren't interested. And neither does he really have the platform within the Egyptian elite to do what he wants to do. The second thing is, I'm convinced, as I've mentioned before, Moses experienced a crushing disappointment when the Hebrew that he tries to help turns against him. That when he said, "Who appointed you a prince and a judge over me?" That rejection by his people burned him, scarred him. And we see that later on when God says, "I'm going to send you back there to lead my people out of slavery." He's going to say, "Nami," because his people will not accept his authority. And he's convinced of that. As a result, we've got the situation where Moses had these very high expectations. In the 40 years that he's growing up in Egypt, he begins acting on those expectations, trying to carry out what he feels like his vocation is, and it all turns sour on him, and he flees, and I think gave up on that whole vocation. He flees and goes into the desert for 40 years. He had to have thought, "My life has come to an end. It's a dead end. What am I going to do now that's of any significance? I'm going to lead sheep for the rest of my life out here where it doesn't make any difference." But it's interesting that there's another sense in which Moses was having the second half of his education. The first half of his education was in Egypt, where he learned the things that you would normally associate with an education. But in the second half, he's been taken out into the desert, and he's going to learn a whole different set of things. He's going to learn about the geography of the Sinai, which is going to become very handy when they spend 40 years wandering around in that very area that he was leading sheep. He's going to learn a lot more about the culture of the people in that area. He's going to learn desert survival skills. But he's also going to have his character worked on, and in particular, he's going to learn humility through this process, which is always a valuable commodity. He's going to learn compassion to a degree that he hadn't learned it before. And he's going to learn patience. After all, he's there for 40 years. So I'm convinced that there was an enormous amount that happened in that 40 years. But through Moses' eye, it must have looked like this is a complete waste of time. And the third thing I want to point out is it is helpful, I think, to read these accounts and keep in mind the time frame of events. It's easy to read through the Old Testament, and you'll see, if we take just Jacob for an example, God appeared to Jacob when he was leaving Canaan and going to Haran. And then just a few chapters later, about three chapters later, God appears to him again as he's coming back from Haran to Canaan. So God is appearing to Jacob every three chapters. That's fairly often. But there's a lot of time that passed between those three chapters. And keeping in mind that time frame is extremely helpful, I think. There's a lot of time when God is silent with respect to Jacob. The same is true with respect to the people of Israel. The people of Israel have been in Egypt for 430 years. Now, I have argued, it's not clear when they came into slavery, but I've argued, and I think it's the case, that they were probably brought into slavery relatively early, and they were probably in slavery most of that time. But the events in the beginning of Exodus describe a time when that enslavement becomes a lot more severe, and a lot more oppressive. But in any case, they're there for a long time, which means there were probably Israelites who prayed for relief from their conditions for their whole lives long and died before the Exodus, seeing no evidence of God moving to address that concern. And yet, God had promised that he would bring them out. He didn't forget his promise. He did act. He just took a long time to do so. And we see Moses, 40 years in the desert. That's a long time. And yet, what is God doing? God is finishing up the preparations that need to be made in Moses as a human being to get him ready for the task that God has set before him. I think that is fascinating. It certainly explains the long periods of silence that I experience in my life with respect to God. But now, Pharaoh has died, and that marks the time when God is going to begin to act to bring his people out of Israel. And Moses is going to play a key role in that, and that's what we'll be tracing as we proceed through the rest of Exodus. Okay, there is time for questions, if anybody has any questions.
There's a wonderful irony in that Hebrews rebuke to Moses, given the role that God will have Moses step into. It's kind of cool the way the author phrases that.
Yes, it is. Yeah, who made you prince or judge over us? And the answer is God. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But you can see that what Moses knows is that even if that answer were given to this guy, he wouldn't buy it. He would not recognize the authority that's been mm-hmm. granted to Moses. That's what Moses knows.
Mm-hmm. I think you're talking about the education of Moses continuing in the wilderness, and it's quite a gift that God brings him to a family headed by a priest of Yahweh. Mm-hmm. It'd be really, I guess I'm asking you, is there more information that we have with regard to how Jethro continued Moses' spiritual formation? Do we have any indication of what it was that Moses received from Jethro or may have learned from him?
To my knowledge, we don't really know. The next scene where Jethro shows up is later, after the Exodus and the people come out of Egypt. Mm-hmm. Jethro sees that Moses has a huge burden judging the people, the disputes that arise in the people of Israel, mm-hmm. and suggests to him a way of alleviating that situation. But that's really all that we have. Mm-hmm. That I'm aware of.
Okay. I think it'd be fascinating to be able to, if it's even possible, delineate what Israel's understanding of Yahweh was retained in Egypt,
yes.
such that Moses would have learned that there versus how much of the nation's understanding of Yahweh was lost, retained by Jethro,
right.
and thus learned right. by Moses later.
That would be very interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that we'll find some clues as we proceed mm-hmm. through, but we don't have a lot of information on that.
Thanks. Lastly, do you
but
see...
But it is how fortuitous it is that he ends up there.
Yes. Do you see any significance in the delineation of his life into the 40 years, and then the 40 years?
I'm not sure what to make of that. 40 is a significant number in the Old Testament. It's used an awful lot of times. And I think in this instance, some people argue that 40 is used symbolically. I'm inclined to think that here, in this instance, it has to be the actual number. But why 40 years, I'm not sure. But it's interesting that it is one-third of his life in Egypt, one-third a shepherd in the desert, and one-third leading the people of Israel. That's amazing. That's quite a life. A lot of time spent in each of those realms.
Do we know what language the Midianites were speaking?
Well, it would have been, I assume it's a Western Semitic language. They would have been Western Semites. So it would have been closely related to the language that the Israelites were speaking in Egypt, I assume. It should have been very closely related.
And do we know like what their religion looks like when it says he's a priest? Like, what
no.
is he doing?
No, and I don't know to what extent Jethro is an exception and to what extent he's the norm within Midian at this particular time. Later on, the Midianites are not Yahwists. When Israel is established as a kingdom, there's no indication that Midianites are Yahwists. But how many there would have been at this time, I don't know. I don't have any way of guessing the proportions there.
Hi, thank you. Hi. I've only listened to 1.5 of your previous weeks since mm-hmm. I haven't been able to be here. But I just want to say I really appreciate how clear you are when you teach. It's
thank you.
Helpful, Roger says. But it's more than that. But thank you. I have a couple small little things in order to get a better feel for the language here. You mentioned that days past equaled a lot of years
right.
earlier.
This is many days.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. And that equaled, that was, you're saying was more like?
Well, it's at least, he says, now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. Presumably that's many days since Moses went to Midian. And if that's the case, then we're talking about 40 years.
Okay. So along that vein, when the narrative about Moses first killing the Egyptian, and then it says the next day mm-hmm. he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was the next day, or do you think it seems kind of dramatic and like really the next
yeah.
day? And
yeah.
so because you said the other thing about those days, I wonder how we're supposed to understand like those kinds of words.
Well, and I don't know, I can't say for sure that we're talking about the very next day
mm-hmm.
because one of the things that's important and something that has been significant to me is recognizing that when I was younger, there was a tendency to think that in order to take the Bible seriously, you need to take it as being literal and precise. And I've since recognized that that's not the way language works. You don't take language seriously by insisting on literalism. You don't take language seriously by insisting on precision. But you take language seriously by trying to take all the clues and figure out what the author's trying to say. And a phrase like the next day, if I were to say that in English, likely it would mean the very next calendar day. But that is not always the case in every language. And in Hebrew, I'm not sure whether it necessitates the very next day or not.
All right. And when, in verse 15, when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. I'm wondering if that might mean something more like he set his intentions towards this, maybe had a meeting or two about it, but not actually went and tried and tripped instead and failed.
Well, my guess is that he issued orders that some soldiers or something go find Moses, bring him in, and with the intention of executing him. That's my guess as to what happened. But Moses had already escaped and was gone before the soldiers came to get him. Now, with respect to your first one about the next day, I think what's happened here is Moses has been put into a situation in which something that has been simmering in him for a long time all of a sudden is busting out, and that God has brought it to a head by having the one thing happen one day and probably the very next day this other thing happened. It probably isn't too long in between them because it's been made known that Moses did this thing, but it hasn't got to the Pharaoh yet to put him to death. So I don't think there's much time between them. So I think God has just created a situation in which it's bang, bang that's causing this thing to come to a head in Moses' psycho-emotional life.
Okay, and lastly, you mentioned, and I've heard you say this before, but something about how God can seem silent. And yet, on the other hand, you were saying that God was preparing Moses, teaching mm-hmm. him compassion and patience and humility. And so we know God, he was active during that time, but maybe possibly Moses' perspective, he could have seemed far away. But I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the silent yet there part of God in your experience even.
That, in my experience, that is really common. And I particularly feel it when there's something that I'm struggling with. I'm in a situation that is, it's hard to know what to do. And no matter what I try to do, things don't get better. And I don't foresee a way that it will resolve itself. And that can go on for a very long period of time. When I'm praying for God to come and help me with the situation, but the situation doesn't appreciably change. And that can go on for years. And I'm thinking, here I am in a very difficult spot. I dearly want God to help me, but I don't see him doing anything. And that goes on for an extended period of time. And it's by faith, based on who I know God to be, from looking at the Bible, that I'm convinced that it doesn't matter what it looks like is happening. That I'm confident that God loves me and is doing what needs to be doing, and he may actually be busy scurrying around to do what needs to be done to constructively deal with the situation that I'm facing. I just can't see the scurrying. It looks like nothing's happening.
The name Reuel tricks me into thinking there's some Yahwehistic reference within his name.
Yes.
So we have an etymology for his name?
There is. It's not certain, but there is. And I didn't write it down. So I'll look that up and I'll mention that next week. But yes, there is the particle L in the name, which is interesting.
Yeah. And this may sound weird, but why do you keep using the term Palestine to describe the area of Canaan?
Because that's what most people know that area by.
Okay.
I'm not making a political statement.
It's just like
that's just geography. Okay. Please don't read anything into that. I'm just referring to the place by the name that most people would know it by.
Okay. And when Moses killed the Egyptian overseer, I'm thinking that there must have been Hebrew overseers. And you could probably get away with killing one of them.
Yes.
But an Egyptian is identified not as an adopted Hebrew who's going through the same thing Moses has gone through, but he's Egyptian.
Yes.
It strikes me that, on one, he probably broke a law. And on second is, suddenly we have a Hebrew acting like the Messiah that the Hebrews are praying for.
Right.
And you can't afford to have that character loose in your kingdom.
Right.
Yeah.
The stupid Hebrew. Who Moses comes and talks to, he is being extremely nasty to a person who is demonstrably willing to help the Hebrews in their plight and in a position to do so. And yet he says, who are you?
Edward G. Robinson.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And that is how incredible that is, I think, that cuts Moses so deeply.
It sounds like a wall that God put in his face to turn him. This isn't going to happen here now.
Absolutely.
You're out of here.
But you can see how Moses would have seen that.
Yeah.
My life has ended. It hadn't ended. It was just a 40-year detour, a little 40-year detour.
Thanks, David. Mm-hmm. So Moses called his son a sojourner.
Gershom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if that could mean exile.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it just means foreigner living in a land that's not his own. It doesn't tell us how he got there. But an exile would be a ger.
Sojourner connotates to me, I'm going back someday. I wondered if Moses was like, someday I'm going to go back to Egypt. Or he's like, no, I'm stuck out in this wilderness forever.
Yeah, so you're raising the question, wouldn't Moses have wanted to go back, right?
Whether he thought that was a possibility.
That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it. My assumption has been he wouldn't have much interest. But I may be wrong. We'll see as we go on. He does go back. His brother comes out. Meets him, and clearly that's a positive experience, I think. So maybe there was some interest in going back.
I kind of doubt it, too.
I kind of doubt it.
I imagine he made himself very comfortable in those 40 years out in the desert.
Well, comfortable. But I think he settled in there. I think he resigned himself to it. That's my guess.
A couple comments. I wonder if the 12, Abraham coming down to Egypt, it seems like they wouldn't have had much money to pay for grain for the 7 years of famine. I wouldn't be surprised if they became enslaved because they're like, well, we don't have any gold to pay you, but we'll work if you give us corn.
Yeah. My suspicion is that while Joseph was alive, that they were probably pretty well cared for. But it is interesting. Joseph says he doesn't want his body to be buried in Egypt. He wants it buried in Canaan. But when Jacob died, right after he died, they took his body to Canaan to be buried. When Joseph dies, they don't take his body. So my suspicion is that Joseph, in his old age, is already no longer enjoying the same status that he had had before. So I don't think it takes too long for Joseph and his descendants to be in a much less privileged situation. And it's in that context that Joseph says, you'll be here for 430 years, and then you'll go back to the promised land. And I think that he's kind of anticipating this is not going to be fun, but there is something for you in the future.
Alter said that the first words that a character says define his character. It seems like this whole first episode defines how Moses' life is going to be.
Yep. We see him, he becomes the ideal person to present the law to Israel because he has such a passion for justice and such a passion for those who have been wronged unjustly. It's very interesting.
I think it's interesting that he seems to have had this idea of bringing justice and some kind of salvation to his whole people. He's like, I'm going to go through his own designs carefully and what he can control. He's going to kill this one Egyptian and help his people. And then when the Hebrew asks, you know, like, who are you? What gives you the power to do this? He doesn't have an answer for this. He's just like, oh, I screwed up. I lost. I've muffed this whole situation. And he runs off. The second time he comes back and he's like, God, I can't do this. It's not my place to do it. And God's like, well, I'm the one doing this. It's not so much you. So he's like, well, who am I going to say that you are? Because they obviously don't trust me. And God's like, well, I'm the guy who does stuff. And you can say that that's the person that tells them to come out.
I think that in that situation where he's confronting the Hebrew, that there is nothing that could have been said, and that Moses recognizes there's nothing that could have been said, and that's what's such a big problem. He recognizes there is no one who can be a leader of Israel. And that's the problem. And that's what it's going to go on to talk about.
Thanks.
Okay. We better quit. Thank you.